Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Delighted to welcome you to the third of this year's Robins lectures, and it's a great pleasure to see members of the Robins family with us this evening. We're very pleased to see them here. Because this is the third lecture, and I imagine a number of people have attended the other two as well, Alan will excuse me if I make my introduction really quite brief, because probably people have gone through his career before. But for those who haven't been at earlier lectures, he is the Bentheim Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton, works in both the economics department and in the Woodrow Wilson School. He has extremely diverse interests, from the economics of terrorism, which we're going to hear about tonight, through the economics of rock and roll to the economics of American football, and I've been trying to encourage him to produce a paper which will outlaw Roman Abramovich from the UK. We need some analysis brought to bear on that. He's written innumerable books and innumerable papers beginning in 1987. I just noticed with one called Reflections on the Inter-Industry Wage Structure with someone called Lawrence Summers. What's he doing these days? That's all I'm going to say by way of introduction. This is the third and concluding lecture on, as you will see, the consequences of terrorism. Alan Krueger, we are delighted to have you here and looking forward to the final lecture.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I think you might say that I helped Larry Summers get off to a good start in his career, and I'm not responsible for what happened since. When Richard Laird first broached the idea of having me deliver these lectures, he said, and I quote, "It's a bit like a marathon to have a speaker give three of the Robins lectures, three nights in a row." And it dawned on me that was a particularly poor analogy to use for me. Because I actually once ran a marathon when I was 18. And being young and ambitious and a little bit crazy, I went out very quickly. I ran the first mile in 5 minutes and 15 seconds. And this was the Jersey Shore Marathon, where you go 13 miles straight up the coast, and then you turn around, and you come 13 miles back, the wind whipping on first your right side, then your left side on the way back. And I remember at the turnaround point, I was number 90 out of 4,000. And I felt pretty good at that point. I finished number 2,000. That means that 1,910 people passed by me. It was really a remarkable experience because they mostly shouted encouragement as they went by. People of all ages, men, women, boys, and girls were going by. So I've tried to pace myself tonight. And just as a reminder for those of you who have been here and for newcomers, the first lecture was on micro evidence on participation in terrorism. The second lecture was at a more aggregate level, looking at the country level, at which countries tend to be more likely a source for terrorists. And in this third lecture, I'm going to talk about the consequences of terrorism. And this is the area where I personally have done the least amount of research. So I'll give you a sense of what I make out of the literature, sprinkling in a little bit of work that I've done myself, but mostly I'll be drawing from others' work. So I won't take it personally if you criticize me more strongly than you have the last two nights for these findings. And what I thought I would do is focus first on the economic consequences of terrorist attacks, then secondly turn to the psychological consequences, third make some comments about the role of the media, and then lastly, and probably briefly, most briefly, try to put the threat of terrorism into some perspective. So first, the economic consequences. There are two views about the impact of terrorism on modern economies like the UK or the US. One view is that the phenomenon of terrorism has a small effect on the economy. And people who have taken that view in the past are Gary Becker and Kevin Murphy in a paper they wrote, a guy named Alan Krueger in a piece that he wrote. And then there's a second view, which is that terrorism has a big effect on the economy. And people have taken that position are Alberto Abadie of the Kennedy School and co-author Javier Guardia Zabal. And it turns out I've also kind of put my foot in that camp. And then I was pleased to discover that Gary Becker has also been on both sides of this divide. So let me walk you through the arguments on both sides of this divide, and then try to make some assessments. So for the small effect crowd, well, the theoretical argument is that terrorist attacks typically have little effect on the amount of physical capital or human capital that's available for production. Moreover, modern economies, if you do a decomposition and you say how much of production is a result of human capital, how much is physical capital, it's mostly human capital that's responsible for high levels of GDP. So if buildings are destroyed, they could be rebuilt. The important thing is to try to protect people. And fortunately, the terrorist attacks that we've witnessed, by and large, have not affected large shares of the population directly. Second theoretical consideration is that there's a great deal of scope for substitution among factors of production. You really can't sell human ingenuity short. Here's an example. After the September 11th attacks on New York City, a good deal of the physical space for the finance industry, and certainly of the prime space, was destroyed or uninhabitable. So what did the investment banks and the hedge funds and the architecture firms that were located in that section of town do? Some of them moved into hotel rooms. They set up shop in hotel rooms, which actually had vacancies because people were scared about traveling. So here's an example where we have a shock to the way we're used to doing business, and companies adapted, and they were able to find other ways of producing the same output that they were producing before, taking advantage of available resources. They also managed to find space that they weren't using so efficiently before, like space in basements and things like that. So the opportunity to substitute inputs is one way in which the effect of terrorism on the economy is mitigated. Well, this is all fine in theory. What's the evidence? Well, first and foremost, past natural disasters have had typically transient effects. I wrote Hurricane Andrew here as an example. Interestingly, in the piece that Gary Becker wrote and a piece that I wrote in the New York Times, we both pointed to a study of the Kobe earthquake, which occurred in Japan in January 1995. It's the most destructive earthquake to ever have hit a modern city. 100,000 buildings were destroyed and 250,000 were damaged. 300,000 people became homeless, and 6,500 people were killed. So clearly this was a drastic shock to Kobe. Yet if you look 15 months later, manufacturing was at 98% of its pre-earthquake trend. So it was back almost exactly where you'd expect it to be. 80% of the stores had reopened, and there was also an investment boom rebuilding homes and office buildings. And the story is similar if you look at the cleanup after Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Hugo in the United States. And the lore is that after the Allied bombings in Germany, the cities recovered very quickly. And I presume the same is the case in London. Also, if you study what happens to cities when they're targets of terrorist attacks, they tend to recover pretty well and pretty quickly. There's a book about New York City, which I'd actually recommend to you, called The Resilient City, which was published by the Russell Sage Foundation a year ago, which found remarkable resilience in New York, and looking at things like property values, which you might think would be affected, unemployment, and so on. And my impression, and I actually read something by Mervyn King, that London also was quite resilient after the July 7th attacks. So that's on the small effect side. What about the big effect side of the argument? Well, first, some key industries can be hit hard, such as the finance industry and the travel industry. Secondly, people might overreact. And I put here, the overreaction might be rational or irrational. We tend to think of overreaction as irrational. But as I'll argue or show you later, Gary Becker has recently been arguing that, well, it might be rational to have fear even if it's not backed up by the risk that people face. I think that's a little bit of a stretch. But people might overreact, might not go shopping. That was a real fear in the U.S. Consumption might fall, and people were very closely watching the consumer confidence numbers. Consumption didn't drop off. Another reaction, which could cause a big effect, is the government can make missteps. For example, government could, one of the things I wrote, which I actually think is probably one of the bigger risks for the economy, is the government could crack down on immigration. And for an economy like the U.S. and probably the U.K. as well, immigration is an important source of economic growth. It's an important source of energy in the economy and ingenuity. And in the U.S., it's an important source of high-skilled labor. And universities in the United States have been having a lot more difficulty because of red tape that has been put up for visas for students to come to graduate school and so on. So I think that that is a potential concern, an example of government misstep. There are others. For example, you might invade a country, which it turns out to be very difficult to manage. then lastly, I wanted to emphasize the idea that uncertainty could increase and probably does increase after attacks like 9/11. Nick Bloom, who's here, lent me a slide that I could show you from his work. This shows monthly stock market volatility around some key events. So this is looking at, Nick will correct me if I get this wrong, hopefully privately. It's looking at the S&P 100 stocks and a measure of daily movements each month. And you could see that 9/11, which is circled in red, was a period, that month was a period of very high volatility in the stock market, higher volatility than the same month when Enron had serious financial scandals. And there was concern that those problems might be rife throughout the industry. So what does this mean? Well, if there's uncertainty, as Nick has pointed out in a recent paper, companies might pause when it comes to investment, when it comes to hiring. And this could cause a slowdown. I don't know if, we'll come back to this actually, if Nick's work belongs in the big effect or the small effect chart, because the turndown in his work and his estimation would be transitory, although it could be quite substantial. We could be talking about half a year's GDP growth being erased because of a terrorist attack. So what is the evidence for the big effect side of the argument? Well, there's some research which suggests that earthquakes may have little short-run impact on economic activity, but maybe they have a larger long-run impact. So Hines and Yamarillo, who are at University of Michigan, have found that in the short run, earthquakes actually do seem to be associated with an investment boom, but in the long run, the capital stock is lower than it otherwise would have been, which stands to reason because you might replace the capital that was there, but you're using up savings to do that. So the steady state capital stock would be reduced. They estimate that over the long run, earthquakes can cause about a 2% drop in GDP. Secondly, there's some evidence that foreign direct investment is reduced if a country is particularly prone to terrorist attacks, and that's work by Alberto Abadi and Javier Gardizabal. And what I actually consider to be the most persuasive work on the big effect side is work that Abadi and Gardizabal have done on the Basque region in Spain. So let me describe that to you a little bit. What they did was to take various regions of Spain and say which ones look like they match up well economically, demographically to the Basque region, and then to go through a fairly sophisticated econometric procedure to weight the different regions to come up with sort of a synthetic region, a region that they think would represent the experience of the Basque region if it were not for a rise in ETA terrorism. This chart is taken from their paper in the American Economic Review in March of 2003. As a little bit of background, the Basque separatist movement, which had been around for some time, didn't really turn violent until the late 60s and didn't really turn violent on a large scale into the mid-70s. And what this chart shows you, the dark line is the GDP per capita in the Basque region each year in U.S. dollars, thousands of U.S. dollars. So you can see that's rising from $4,000 up to about $10,000. And the dashed line is GDP per capita in the comparison regions. And the comparison regions actually track the Basque region very well in the period before the outbreak of terrorism on a wide scale. After the outbreak of terrorism on a wide scale, you can see the comparison regions were growing more strongly than the Basque region. And by the late 1970s, the gap is about 10% of GDP. But by the way, you probably noticed, I didn't define what I meant by big and small. I left that suitably vague. 10% I would consider big. If an area as large as the Basque region suffers a 10% decline in GDP, I would say that the terrorism has had a substantial effect on the economy. If we're talking about 1% or 2%, especially if it's transient, I would say it's small. And then we could kind of debate about the mid-range. And what Abadi and Gardizabal found was that the timing lines up pretty well with the number of fatalities. So the dashed line on this chart is the GDP gap between the Basque region and the comparison regions. And the solid line is the number of fatalities that are stemming from terrorist activity. And you can see that they tend to move pretty well together, that the GDP gap opened up in a period when the fatalities were high and rising. This type of work would, I think, be quite useful to do in other areas to see how robust it is. Maybe this is unique to Spain. Maybe it's a general pattern. Wanted to mention one other type of study that's been done on the effect of terrorism on the economy. And this is based on stock market event studies. And there have been several stock market event studies which look at sort of portfolios of companies or look at companies in different, based in different regions or based in different industries. But the only one I'm aware of that looks at how the stock value of companies that are targeted by terrorist attacks respond to those attacks is a new paper by Andrew Caroli and Rodolfo Martel, two American economists. And what they've done is to estimate a standard type of stock market event model. So the idea is the movement in the stock should depend in part on past history, how that particular company stock tends to move with the overall market. So what they've done is to track down 75 terrorist attacks that were targeted on publicly traded companies. For example, a McDonald's outlet in Pakistan could be the target of a terrorist attack. They drew their data from the Patterns of Global Terrorism Report, which the U.S. State Department prepares each year, and which I described last night. That's what that wonderful little tape from John Stewart was about. And they took these 75 attacks where they could identify the company that looked like it was the target of the attack, and they estimated the way in which the company's stock tended to move together with the overall market return in the roughly 200 days before the terrorist attack. And then they looked at what happened in the period just before the terrorist attack, the day of the terrorist attack, and subsequently. I'll show you that in a moment. And I think their work was pretty careful. They if they wanted to dramatize their results, they would have included the airlines that were targeted or part of the attacks on September 11th, because those stocks really plummeted. But they excluded them because they thought that would skew their results too much. So in some sense, this is a bit of a conservative estimate. So what do they find? This looks at the average for the 75 companies and the abnormal return. That's the difference in the stock return compared to how that company's return would be expected to move on that day given the market movements. And what they find, if you look at the week before the terrorist attack, the stock movements tend to be moving in step with the historical pattern. There's no abnormal return. There's statistically insignificant differences from the predicted return on those days. On the day of the terrorist attack, for these 75 companies, the stock price falls by 0.83%. And you could easily reject chance as an explanation for a movement of this size. It's very unlikely to have occurred just by random blips in the way that stock prices move. And then if you look at the subsequent week, there's actually not an indication of lower growth or of a recovery in the stock price. It seems to drop by about 0.8% and roughly stay there. The other movements look like they're all consistent with just chance movements. So what does this translate to in terms of dollars? Well, it suggests that the value of the companies fall by about $400 million for each terrorist attack. Now, of course, it's not the same for all companies. This is the five largest cumulative losses because of terrorist attacks. And this could involve more than one attack. So Royal Dutch Shell might have been the target of three attacks in this period. But this accumulates all of those events. And you can see that Royal Dutch Shell, British Petroleum, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and American Airlines had the biggest losses in value because of terrorism over this period based on their estimates. They had some other really interesting results. One is that the volume of shares that were traded seemed to be unaffected by the terrorist attacks. Another is that if you look at competing companies, so if you look at Burger King on a day when McDonald's happened to have been attacked, they don't see any change in Burger King's stock market value. It seems to be focused on the company that was the target of the attack, which in a way is a little bit surprising to me because you might think there was some information that was revealed. The terrorists are targeting fast food restaurants. It's not that big a leap to go from McDonald's to Burger King. You might think that that would have some impact on Burger King. A third finding, which I really find quite intriguing, is that kidnappings of executives caused the biggest loss. So they categorized the types of terrorist attack. It could have been a bomb that exploded. It could have been someone firing an automatic rifle. One of the types of attacks that they had was kidnappings of executives, and that had the largest effect on the stock market value, which is consistent with the idea that the loss of human capital has a large impact on companies. Human capital is very valuable. It's also consistent with other work which looks at what happens when a CEO dies in office, what happens to the value of a company, which tends to have a very large adverse effect on the value of publicly traded companies. Then lastly, they looked at where the countries were based. Were they based in a wealthy country? Were they based in a democratic country? How did the market values respond for companies based in different types of countries? And what they found was that the reactions of the stock market were greatest for companies whose home base was in a democratic country and in a wealthier country, which is a bit consistent, I suppose, with evidence I showed you last night that terrorists are more likely to target victims, companies, embassies, individuals that are from wealthier countries and from more democratic countries. Perhaps they intuitively feel that they have a larger impact by doing so. There may be other reasons too. It may be that those are the countries that they feel if they attack can help to advance their agenda. So what does this all total up to? Are these estimates big or small? And as I thought about them, I guess they were smallish. So let me give you a kind of a back-of-the-envelope calculation. Suppose that each terrorist attack on a company causes a $401 million decline, a $400 million loss of value. Based on the State Department data, there are 16 significant terrorist attacks a year in this period against the United States. Now, this is not only against companies. Some of it is against individuals. Some of it affected individuals. Some of it affected the U.S. Embassy, or perhaps philanthropies that were based abroad, and so on. But let's suppose you take the $400 million figure for each of these and you multiply it out. So that suggests a loss of about $6.4 billion a year, which is quite a small share of GDP, just 0.064% of GDP. So I put that in the small camp. On the other hand, one could easily argue that this calculation is preposterous, that the effects of terrorism spread beyond just the immediate victims, just counting up the number of events. This misses all of those spillover effects. And very soon I'm going to talk about psychological impacts, which I do think are broader than the effects on the immediate victims. But even if this estimate is wildly off, you know, suppose it's off by a factor of 30, you're still talking about less than 2% of GDP. So I guess it gets into the moderate range. So what do I take away from the research on the economic impacts of terrorism? Well, I think quite clearly in some industries, the direct effect of terrorism is large. You know, the tourism industry, the travel industry. Also, a point I would emphasize is the terrorist organizations are quite adept at targeting industries and countries which are the most vulnerable. And I was thinking as I kind of wrote this out, I don't know if you're aware that during World War II, the American economist Wassily Leontief developed input-output models as an aid for determining targets for bombing in Germany. The terrorists seem to have an intuitive feel for where they would have the most leverage, and they're targeting those industries. I would say the jury is still out on the effect of terrorism overall. I still lean towards the small effect crowd, which is where I first took a position. On the other hand, I'm open-minded, and I think the evidence from Spain is reasonably compelling. And one of the, I think, important features of this is that if the terrorism is frequent and if it's sustained, as it was in the Basque region, then I suspect that you're talking about a much larger effect. If we have a situation like September 11th, which was a horrific attack, created a tremendous amount of uncertainty, as Nick Bloom pointed out, but it doesn't seem to have caused a sustained amount of terrorism within, at least within the United States, then I suspect that the estimates are pretty close to what Nick Bloom had calculated, a loss of GDP of, say, 1.5%, you know, in that ballpark, but then a rebound after that, and the long-run effect is close to zero. And I think one of the advantages that economies like the U.S. and the U.K. have is that they're very diverse. There are multiple ways of producing, so there are not critical sectors which I think would sink, you know, which could possibly sink an economy which was not so flexible. Let me next turn to the psychological impact. And there are a lot of ways I think you could approach the psychological impact of terrorism, and you'll recall from the definition of terrorism I have in mind, the terrorists intend to influence a wide audience, to wreak fear among a wide audience. And one could look at some objective statistics. For example, there's evidence that after September 11th, alcohol consumption increased in New York by 25%. Doctors' visits increased. There's an interesting study looking at Israel by a colleague of mine at Princeton named Josh Goldstein, who looked at car accidents, fatal car accidents, after major terrorist attacks in Israel. And he found in the few days after a major terrorist attack, fatal accidents went up. Interestingly, non-fatal ones went down. And his interpretation was that people were probably distracted while they were driving. That effect seemed to dissipate after a few days. But I'm not going to dwell on these objective statistics. I'm going to do something more ambitious and maybe more foolish, which is to look at data on subjective well-being and on mental health. So let me turn to a study by Roxanne Cohn-Silver and co-authors that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association on the first anniversary of the September 11th attacks. And there are many studies that find fairly similar results to Cohn's work, to Silver's work. The reason why I selected her work is she's done other work on the phenomenon of adaptation when it comes to subjective well-being. So, and this is closely related to Richard Laird's Robbins lecture. There's a large literature in psychology that finds that even very severe events, changes in people's lives, tends to have transitory effects on their reported subjective well-being. In Silver's work, I remember she had an interesting study where she looked at what happened when someone's house burned down. And very quickly, in a matter of a month or two, people's reported life satisfaction was up to about where it was before their house burned down. So people seem to return to a fairly stable point. So I was interested to see if you see the same type of phenomenon when it comes to terrorism. Now, there are some phenomena where you don't see adaptation. For example, chronic pain. If people are struck by some type of ailment which causes chronic pain, that's something that sticks with them and it seems to permanently lower their life satisfaction. Being laid off, especially if the individual is the only one in the company who was laid off, also has a kind of more permanent effect on life satisfaction. But from what I can tell from this literature, winning the lottery or becoming a paraplegic seems to have a very small, surprisingly small effect, mostly transient effect on people's life satisfaction. Well, what about terrorist attacks? So what this research team did was to tap into something called the Knowledge Network's Web TV samples. It's kind of an amazing survey technique. This is a company based in Stanford, which has set up, I think it's around 60,000 households in the US with Web TV. And they give them the Web TV apparatus. They could use it for email. They could use it to watch TV. They can use it for whatever they want. But once a week, they have to fill out a questionnaire on the Web TV. And they arranged to do a survey of the US population. Here I'm going to show you results that focus outside of New York City, but New York is, you know, New York is 4% of the US population, so even if you included it, it wouldn't be too different. But it is interesting to see how reactions spread outside of New York after September 11th. And what did she find? Well, they used a diagnostic technique to look at post-traumatic stress. And there are various criteria for defining acute stress. And it's a little bit like a Chinese menu where you could have some of this category and some of that category. But the categories that they look at are phenomena such as re-experiencing an event, like having a nightmare or a flashback to the event. Avoidance, where avoidance means that you avoid doing something which will remind you of that event. Arousal / anxiety. Here, arousal really means kind of lack of arousal. People become insomniacs. They have difficulty concentrating. They become jumpy, anxious. Those are the kinds of symptoms that she's looking at. And this is an overall measure where to have acute stress, you need to have multiple types of symptoms. When they looked 2 months after the September 11th attacks, 17% of the U.S. population was suffering symptoms of acute or post-traumatic stress. When they followed up 6 months later, that dropped to 5.8%. Here is a chart which looks not at this overall measure, but just at the arousal anxiety component, which to me was rather remarkable. 3 weeks, this is where it says 3 weeks, that's an interval from really 1 week to about 3 weeks after September 11th, close to 60% of the U.S. population had some symptom of anxiety or difficulty concentrating and so on. At 2 months, that dropped almost in half to 30%. And at 6 months, it was still noticeable, 10%, but certainly had fallen quite a bit. Other research finds the same kind of pattern. If you look at New York City, or if you look at distance from New York, you see a higher incidence of stress, of post-traumatic stress for people who live near New York City. This study looked at some other indicators of the of individuals' background characteristics, and it reached the following conclusion. The psychological effects of a major national trauma are not limited to those who experience it directly, and the degree of response is not predicted simply by objective measures of exposure to or loss from the trauma. Now, my sense is the objective measures actually do predict reasonably, but that's not the only thing that predicts the amount of stress that people suffer as a result of these attacks. Let me mention a little bit of other evidence which I've been working on, which is based on a technique called experience sampling. With experience sampling, individuals carry around a portable computer, like a Palm Pilot, like you see here, and either at random intervals or regular intervals, the Palm Pilot beeps and it asks questions like, just before this beeped, how did you feel? Did you feel sad? Did you feel anxious? Did you feel impatient to do something else? And one of the advantages of this technique is, the hope is, and there's some evidence for this, that it kind of taps into people's ongoing experiences. It's not through the filter of their memory. Also, they're reporting how they feel at that moment. They're not asked how they feel in general, which might depend upon how they think they should feel in general. There's no standard of comparison, or at least it's hoped that there's not a standard of comparison here. So I was able to get data kind of just almost by accident from a study that was being done in Wisconsin, which is one of the reasons why I showed you results for outside of New York earlier. Of individuals who were undergoing a study on smoking cessation, but it turned out it started the week before September 11th. So unlike the other study I showed you, I could actually look before. And I asked the people who collected the data to provide me some tabulations, which they did. So this is based on data that Timmy Baker and his co-authors have provided. So the way I have this arrayed is I'm looking in the week before September 11th, on September 11th, which is day zero, and then in the week after September 11th. And quite frequently during the day, individuals who were part of the study were asked, how sad do you feel? And what you can see is on September 11th, a large jump in the reported sadness. And then a little bit like what Cohn-Silver had found in her earlier work on fires, within 4 days, it looks like we're back down to the baseline level within 4 days of September 11th. Now, I can't quite explain what happened to these last 3 days because it seems to be blipping up. And I've been trying to get additional data because this study, I believe, continued for some days after the week after September 11th. In case you're wondering, this is not contaminated by the smoking cessation that occurred later. Interestingly, the Palm Pilot also asked questions about enthusiasm. So in addition to sadness, another emotion that can be tapped into is how enthusiastic do you feel? And it looks like September 11th had a bigger effect and a more lasting effect on the enthusiasm of people in Wisconsin than it did on their feelings of sadness. You can see that, and this is probably related to some of the evidence on the post-traumatic stress outside of New York, that people's level of enthusiasm declined. And remember, that's measured kind of moment to moment. That's during the course of the day, how enthusiastic did they feel at that time. Let me turn now to kind of more conventional data on people's subjective well-being. And what I mean by more conventional data is self-reports on life satisfaction. And there's an interesting new paper by Bruno Frey, Simon Lukinger, and Alois Stutzer, which uses data from the Eurobarometer surveys, which asks the following life satisfaction question. On the whole, are you very satisfied? They gave that a score of 4. Fairly satisfied, the score of 3. Not very satisfied, the score of 2. Or not at all satisfied, the score of 1, with the life that you lead. And what they've done is to try to link up data from the Eurobarometer surveys from 1973 through 1998 with information on the amount of terrorist attacks occurring in different regions of Great Britain, Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and France. And the analysis that they've done is to look within countries to look at London and other regions. London has a higher risk of terrorism historically than the rest of England. So their analysis was done within countries. And they related individuals' reported life satisfaction to the amount of income that they earned, to the amount of terrorist activity in their region. And terrorist activity was measured by fatalities in that year or by the number of incidents of terrorism. They also controlled for overall countrywide time effects, overall region effects, which didn't vary with time, and some other personal characteristics. And what did they find? Well, if you reduce the amount of, according to the correlations they find in the data, a reduction in the amount of terrorism by one standard deviation, which is about 8 incidents per year for England, that's the equivalent, if you look at France, of taking 3% of the population and moving them from saying that they're very satisfied to only fairly satisfied. Or for Britain, I guess the Brits seem to respond a bit more, going from 5% who were very satisfied to only fairly satisfied, and 4% for the Irish. So these numbers are fairly similar. Now, is this a big or a small effect? It's interesting to me that you can actually pick it up, because that suggests that there was not complete adaptation. And again, I don't know how general these results are. I think it would be very interesting to do this kind of work in other countries. If you compare the magnitudes of the effects they find, it's about a tenth as large as the loss in reported life satisfaction associated with becoming unemployed. Now, that might not sound so big, but remember, this is affecting the whole country or everyone in the region. If the unemployment rate is 10%, that suggests this is on the order of magnitude just as important as the whole phenomenon of unemployment in terms of life satisfaction for the people. The second approach they have, which I considered a little bit dodgy, is to try to turn this into a dollar figure. And they do that by using their estimates of how income affects people's life satisfaction. Think of that as an estimate of the marginal utility of income. And then they take the ratio of the estimates of the effect of terrorism on life satisfaction to the estimate of income on life satisfaction. And they come up with the bottom line that people in London would be willing to forego 32% of their income to obtain the lower level of terrorism that exists in the rest of the country. Now, that strikes me as an extraordinarily high number. And I wonder if it's a little bit overly dramatized, because the denominator for this ratio is not very clearly estimated. And there's a very large literature, which Richard Lehrer talked about in his Robbins lectures, suggesting that people vastly overestimate the impact of income on their happiness. So because income doesn't buy you that much happiness, buys you some, but not that much more happiness, that tends to blow up this ratio quite a bit. Anyway, it's interesting to me that you do see effects throughout the population in the regions that are affected by terrorism. It seems to lower life satisfaction to a measurable degree. So this brings me back to work by Gary Becker. Gary Becker and Yonah Rubinstein have looked at, kind of raised the question, how do people respond to terrorism? And it seems that people are swayed by fear of terrorism, not by a rational calculation of the risk that they face. And let me actually preface this by saying there's a competing view, an alternative view of the world, which relates to work by my colleague Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, which finds that people tend to overestimate small risks. So in Kahneman and Tversky's work on prospect theory, for which Kahneman won the Nobel Prize, the idea is that people make mistakes. They kind of overestimate small probabilities, so they overreact. They treat a risk, even though it's a very small risk, as being much more pronounced, much greater than it actually is. And Becker and Rubinstein took aim at that view, and their alternative way of addressing this problem is to say, you know, no, people don't make mistakes, they're rational. You just have to recognize that there's this element of people's well-being which is called fear. Fear is an element of their utility function, and as a result, it's not the probability that's affected, it's their utility directly. The evidence they have for this, I have to say, is rather weak, and I think also consistent with Kahneman and Tversky's view of the world. But the evidence they have is the following. If you look, for example, at Israel, after terrorist attacks, take an incident where there was a bombing on a bus, well, not so surprisingly, there are fewer passengers on buses subsequently. But if you look at whose purchase of bus passes, bus tickets declines, it tends to be the people who are casual bus riders. People who use buses regularly don't see a change, don't experience a change, don't take buses less frequently. And their interpretation of this is that there's a fixed cost to overcoming your fear. It may be rational to have fear, but you could also work on overcoming your fear. Now, you can think of lots of different explanations for this. For example, maybe the people who are regular bus riders have no choice. They have to get to work, and that's how they get to work. So they're really scared while they're on the bus, but they didn't overcome their fear, but they had to take the bus. But they also point to something interesting, which is if you look at going out to cafes after incidents of an explosion at a cafe, there are fewer people go to cafes, but the people who regularly go to cafes don't cut down nearly as much as the people who are less frequent, more casual consumers at cafes. So they argue that this suggests there's a fixed cost to overcoming your fear. People can make the effort to overcome fear, but it's only worth doing if you're somebody who kind of regularly goes to cafes. Otherwise, the fixed cost looms very large, and you don't make the investment to overcome it. I find this an intriguing argument, and not necessarily compelling. For example, you could argue that instead of overcoming their fixed costs, what they're doing is they're teaching themselves what the real probabilities are, what the real risks are. So you could think about this still in the framework of Kahneman and Tversky. And what might be going on is that they're just becoming rational frequentists instead of irrational emotional responders. And I think you get to the same place. On the other hand, I find it quite intriguing that Becker and Rubenstein's work, together with the work, you know, the implications of prospect theory, suggest that this phenomenon, which seems to be very well documented, that fear does spread throughout the population after terrorist attacks, can be overcome. Whether it's rational or irrational, it can be overcome. I tend to think a lot of it has to do with not understanding what the actual risks are or being unable to put the risks in context, which is something I'll come back to. Let me say a little bit about the role of the media, and last night I received a question about this. I think the role of the media is quite important here because we're talking about attacks that take place and then they spread throughout the population beyond the immediate area, and they're propagated to some extent. I think the way they were experienced to a large extent is propagated through the media. This is kind of interesting. This is, as you know, Americans watch a lot of television. They watch an enormous amount on September 12th. This is the number of hours of television watched on the day after September 11th. And almost half of the population watched 8 hours of television news on September 12th. People were glued to the television sets. 73% watched four or more. I think I was in the eight and over category. So I think the role of the media, especially since you see such a large reaction right after terrorist attacks occur, is quite important. And I want to emphasize that the media is often inaccurate, the way things are reported. I think we should expect the initial reporting to be inaccurate. I have some theories for why, and I'll give you some examples of the inaccuracies. First, the media outlets have a strong incentive to try to be the first to break a story. Especially in television. They want to draw watchers away from other channels. So you have this race to get things out there, which I think lowers the standard of evidence that one would want to use. Secondly, there's no accountability for experts or for anonymous sources. Third, and I think this is to some extent, or to a large extent, unavoidable, there's government secrecy. The government doesn't want to show its cards if it's still trying to track down individuals who perpetrated a terrorist attack. And I consider that to be entirely legitimate. There's also government deception, which sometimes may be legitimate and sometimes may not be. By deception, I mean putting out a false story, possibly, to try to lead to more, prevent panic, to keep people calm. I mentioned a few nights ago, I was once on an airplane and we had to make an emergency landing. And the pilot said that he was making the landing just in case because the air conditioning wasn't working and the instruments might fail. Then after we landed, he mentioned to the flight attendant who was near me that the instruments failed and he had to make an emergency landing. And I didn't know whether to be mad or relieved. And I think there may be elements like that with the way the government or some governments address terrorist attacks. And then there's also just an enormous amount of confusion after terrorist attacks. So this leads me to recommend that the population discount the early reporting, which is a little bit tricky because you want people to pay attention because they may still be at risk, especially for biological terrorism. So you want them to respond, but you don't want them to over-respond. So I think this is very tricky, and I think, I'll say this again later, I think the government can do a lot more in educating the public and providing information to the media. So let me give you some examples. The AP ran a story on July 7th. Police said there had been no warning and that the blasts at three subway stations went off within 26 minutes, starting at 8:51 a.m. in an underground train just outside the financial district. Authorities initially blamed a power surge, but realized it was a terror attack after the bus bombing near the British Museum at 9:47 a.m. Now, of course, we now know that they occurred within 50 seconds of each other. Also, there's some question whether they initially did believe there was a power surge or whether that was a story to maintain calm. I'm not sure that's been resolved. And there was, of course, a lot of other misreporting. For example, I think it was initially claimed that the authorities had no knowledge, had no past reason for tracking the known perpetrators for the July 7th attacks. I think the term that was used was cleanskins, yet it turns out that at least two members were under surveillance. So there were some other instances, I think, that you could think about going back to July 7th. In general, it's not unusual for the reporters to get to be wrong about the strength or sophistication of the attacks. There was a lot of debate about whether it was sophisticated or not sophisticated in that case. To be wrong about the origin of the perpetrators, to be wrong about the target of the attack, I'll show you something on that in a moment, or the timing. So basically, who, what, when, and where. So here's some other examples. From Madrid, the March 11th attacks, the UK Newsquest and a number of other presses, probably helped by government sources, called this the deadliest attack ever by the Basque separatist group ETA. And we now know, of course, it wasn't perpetrated by ETA. On September 11th, CNN reported that there was an explosion on Capitol Hill. ABC News reported that there was a car bomb exploded outside the State Department, which neither of those fortunately happened. Oklahoma City, the Mura building, the federal building, which was a case of domestic terrorism in the U.S., that was Timothy McVeigh. The FBI reportedly was seeking three men of apparently Middle Eastern descent seen fleeing the bombing scene, as a memo indicated that investigators were looking at the terror group Islamic Jihad. So a tremendous amount of misinformation. And also related to this, I think the press has an incentive to sensationalize. And this got under my skin, so I thought I'd mention it to you. 2 weeks ago, I was watching CNN, and there was a case, I don't know if it made it to the news here, it shouldn't have, but maybe it did, that the Russell Senate office building had been evacuated. There was concern that an automatic sensor detected some type of a nerve agent or chemical agent. The first test had detected this. The second one was actually negative, and they were doing a third test. And I got sucked into this on CNN, so I was watching for about an hour and a half. And CNN brought on an expert on biological terrorism who really seemed quite knowledgeable. And he pointed out, and what happened in this case is that people were evacuated down to the parking garage, and he got on the cell phone. There were reports on people calling up at other cell phones saying there's no symptoms. You know, no one is coughing, no one's sneezing, no one has watery eyes. And he pointed out those would be the symptoms of a chemical attack, and certainly from nerve agents. So, and he also pointed out that there are a lot of false positives with these automatic sensors. And I had the sense that Paula Zahn felt that she was losing her audience. So we had the following. And then another reporter, Kelly Arena, who's another reporter on CNN, quite a good reporter, Paula Zahn said the following. We just had Kelly Arena, who has reported through her Homeland Security sources for everybody to take a deep breath, here, and sort of hold our breath until these tests are done. They're urging extreme caution and jumping to any conclusions about what we're talking about. That was good. And yet, this is where I thought she was worried about losing her audience, when you hear that you now have eight senators, it actually turned out to be only four, as well as 200 Senate staffers who are holed up in the building parking lot, more or less. Maybe quarantined is too strong of a word, but definitely hold up. It does make you wonder about this alarm that, in fact, went off in the attic of the Russell building. So I watched another half an hour, and it turned out that it was a false alarm. They were ordering pizzas in the parking lot of the garage, and it kind of went about things. I wanted to highlight this. I learned about this last week. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has a guide for the media on what to do and how to understand, how to respond to terrorism and other public health emergencies. And I would say, to their credit, they actually requested this work before September 11th. And in the great American tradition, which I see is spreading to England, this work was contracted out to a private company. I'm on their board, so that's how I learned about this. And they put together an absolutely beautiful report. It's actually printed. It's very heavy. It's long, but that's not the reason why it's heavy. It's printed on paper that's resistant to a chemical attack. I kid you not. And it's beautifully prepared, and it describes the symptoms. They also put this together. I wanted to show this to you. The pocket guide. It condenses the book. And it's marvelous, and it says the things that the expert said, who CNN had on about the types of symptoms to expect for mustard gas and nerve agents and so on. It has radiological, biological, and then on the back it has phone numbers that you should have written down in advance, who you should need to call. Of course, make sure your family is safe. It's really, really quite helpful, well thought out. I don't know how many copies have actually been read, but it is actually the kind of preparation that I think should be done and could help, first of all, get out accurate information, and secondly, prevent overreaction. The other thing which it did is it has a chart inside it. Oops. It has a chart in the body of the report which tries to put various types of hazards into perspective. So it calculates for various causes of death. What is the risk in a given year for the U.S. population? So for heart disease, 1 in 300 people in America would die of heart disease in a year, 1 in 4 over the lifetime. Cancer is 1 in 510, pneumonia 1 in 4,000. Anthrax, and this is for 2001, which is the year that the anthrax was mailed to the U.S. Capitol and NBC News, 1 in 56 million. Motor vehicle accident, 1 in 6,700, and so on. So I calculated terrorism attack. It's 1 in a million. That's worldwide. If you did it just for the U.S., it's a little bit higher, but you kind of get the idea. It's relatively low risk. It's between accidental electrocution and lightning. It's about a third of the chance of getting struck by lightning. And I think when the press, you know, if the press has these numbers, it could try to put these risks in some perspective. And that's where I wanted to conclude these lectures, to try to place terrorism in perspective. And one of the things I did to prepare, since after all this is the Lionel Robbins lecture series, is I went back to one of Lionel Robbins' books, The Economic Problem in Peace and War, which was delivered as a series of lectures, Marshall lectures, at Cambridge University in the book was published in 1947. And it was a beautifully written book. I also wanted to point this out to you. This is kind of fun. When I take out an old book in the library, I like to look at the card in the back, see who else checked it out. Unfortunately, with the new computer system, they don't put your name on it, so future generations won't have this thrill. But Oscar Morgenstern checked out the book in 1953. Oscar Morgenstern, of course, is co-author with John von Neumann of The Theory of Games. And I was the first person to check it out since 1965. So in any event, having read through the book, what was remarkable to me is how different the problem that was faced during World War II is from the problem that we face today. I was going to read this one passage. In total war, there's only one prime object of policy, the achievement of total victory. To that object, all other aims are subordinate. By that criterion, all special operations must be judged. Whatever may be the outcome of victory, whether it be a positive gain or a position perceptibly worse than that from which you started, if the alternative is annihilation, then, while the will to survive persists at all, no sacrifice seems too great. And the risks that we face today, if you go back, you know, to this table, clearly are not risks so far of annihilation. Now, I think a fear, and perhaps this is a fear that's motivated some of the positions taken by the Bush administration, which otherwise I couldn't understand, is that things might escalate to a level where we're talking about catastrophic risk. But certainly that's not where we are today. And also it's the case in the U.S. that no sacrifice has been asked in this war, despite the claim that one often hears from leaders, at least in the U.S., that this is an epic battle, a war of historic significance. It doesn't seem to me to compare to the struggle that took place during World War II. If I had more time, I would read you more from Lionel Robbins' book, but I should conclude. What do I take away from the consequences of terrorism? It seems to me that terrorism only matters in a big way if we let it, at least the terrorism that we've experienced so far, and that I suspect that we're likely to experience in the near future. The immediate harm is relatively small compared to the size of the economy. Now, of course, it may cause uncertainty. I don't know if that level of uncertainty is because of rational responses or irrational responses. But for one-off attacks, it seems to me that that uncertainty lapses and doesn't have a lasting impact. I think the media needs to be more responsible in reporting on terrorist attacks and needs to take a deep breath, as Paul Lauzon recommended. The government, I think, also needs to be more responsible not to exploit these tragedies or to try to cover their tracks, but to prepare the country. One of the things that we learned from Katrina in the U.S. is that multiple layers of government can fail. And I think it's very important for the government to rehearse and to respond, to rehearse to different scenarios and to respond. I learned a very interesting story last week. After September 11th, Rudy Giuliani's stock went way up. And it's really quite remarkable because he was going through a very difficult time as mayor, and he was in the middle of an ugly divorce, and really was not a popular mayor until after September 11th. And he did seem calm, and he did restore faith, and he did it without exaggerating. And he had a very famous line. He was asked, you know, how many people were killed, and he said he didn't know. And he said, I quote, "When we get the final number, it will be more than any of us can bear." And that was kind of a very soothing, reassuring, sympathetic comment that he made, whereas in other terrorist attacks, for example, with the anthrax, some public officials have said it's under control when it wasn't under control, and then they lost credibility. I subsequently discovered that Rudy Giuliani actually had rehearsed that line when he went through different scenarios just in his course of being mayor. He, I think, deserves a lot of credit for remembering it, but it wasn't, you know, purely by accident. It's not something I think that kind of trickled off his tongue at the spur of the moment. It's something that he had thought about. The type of terrorism we've seen so far, I think, is a lot more like the Barbary pirates, kind of an inconvenience, required some tribute, but certainly not a major threat to most people's way of life. More like the Barbary pirates than the threat faced during the World War II generation. Yet at the same time, I think what this suggests is that we ought to guard against the most catastrophic threats. So what does that mean? That means investing in radiation sensors, which there is, I know, at least in New York and Washington, quite a bit, quite a number of sensors, sometimes which have false positives. Also, I think it means that we have to pay much more attention to arms control agreements to make sure that there are not weapons of mass destruction floating around or that could reach the market. I also think that we don't want to focus on the last threat. We want to be flexible enough to respond to new kinds of threats. A good example was the natural disaster Katrina. By the way, Don Kennedy, who's a friend and editor of the journal Science, recently wrote that Katrina was not a natural disaster. It was partially related to global warming. So I probably should have put natural disaster in quotes. But if we focus so much, and I think this is what happened, this is actually what has been claimed with Katrina, is that we focus so much on terrorism that when something else struck, we were focusing, our focus was away. The next threat could be domestic, it could be natural disaster, it could be something entirely different. So it seems to me that public officials need to have a broader perspective, at least broader in the U.S., which is focused very much so on terrorism the last 4 years.
Thanks. Well, thank you for an absolutely fascinating summary. And we have time for a few questions, though not that much time. There are microphones around, and in the cheap seat, someone who has caught my eye straight away. If you could give your name first, that'd be great.
Hi, Professor. My name is Masaya Nagisawa. You talked about the effect on the economy at the beginning. I just wonder if there are any relationship with the debt capacity and the finance capacity of that particular sector. You know, obviously, you talked about the quick recovery in Kobe, but the Bank of Japan printed a lot of money after the earthquake. Probably the same thing, like American government, they lent a lot of money to the airline industry after the 9/11. But probably, before ECB era, the Bank of Spain couldn't, you know, lower the interest rate because of inflation. That was one of the reasons why the Basque couldn't catch up the economy to the rest of the world. In that probably context, I guess you know, Japan can't afford any more earthquake after the Kobe at the current situation, debt capacity situation. I just wonder what do you think about this view?
Yep, that's a very good question. I think Japan needs to learn the lessons from the United States that you can continue borrowing and borrowing and seamlessly never have to pay it back. I think that, you know, this is not my field of expertise since I'm a microeconomist, but I'll pretend to be a macroeconomist for a moment. My sense is that there's a very strong consensus that monetary policy is much more responsive and much quicker to respond and probably a more appropriate instrument to use. And I think the Federal Reserve did respond in September, you know, closely monitored what happened in the financial industry. And fortunately, there were enough redundancies, and after a short shutdown, the system was restored. When it comes to fiscal policy, I actually think that this is one of the government missteps. My friend Robert Barrow wrote a piece in Business Week where he said that, maybe it was Wall Street Journal, but he said he's trying to look for the silver lining in September 11th. And one of them is that the government could open up the purse strings, and this idea of having to have responsible government when it comes to the budget, that could break down and we could have tax cuts. And it seems to me to have been a dreadful response, and I think that the president's hand was greatly strengthened, and his agenda of running up deficits is probably will cause more harm to the economy than the direct effect of the attacks. So I think it's something where public officials have to be more responsible when it comes to responding.
We've become rather used to America's role as borrower of last resort, and we hope you don't stop it. Down here at the front.
Alan, I want to suggest something for the apparent change in after the 4 days of the attack. As you remember, there was the telethon, I think it was on the Friday, four days following the attack, so that may be one of the reasons for that apparent jump. My question was on the, I heard all three lectures, and I'm trying to see how you disaggregate between a sustained terrorist campaign, for instance, in a civil war, because it, particularly in the evidence that you presented tonight, it makes a big difference in terms of the, for instance, in the Basque Country, terrorists tend to see them, specifically in that specific instance, as fighting a civil war against the government and the target state targets or state agents, whereas the state sees them as being terrorists. And so how do you disaggregate between those two?
Right. Right. Oh, that's a good question. One of the views I've tried to emphasize is I think of terrorism as something that occurs when situations are not ripe for an all-out civil war, which requires me to define what do I mean by an all-out civil war. And I'm relatively comfortable with the arbitrary but standard definition of more than 1,000 fatalities in a year, which I don't think the Basque region ever reached. The situation in Israel and the West Bank Gaza Strip at certain times has been there. Or I think been awfully close. So that's kind of the working definition that I've had. And by sustained, I think a lot of the uncertainty after September 11th was concern that there'd be additional attacks. You didn't know whether there were sleeper cells and so on. So kind of raising the probability in that short period of time of more frequent attacks, which doesn't seem, fortunately doesn't seem to have occurred.
Next, yeah, near the back there, thanks.
Hi, Professor. You talk about economic consequences of terrorism, especially negative effects of terrorism on economy, but also there are positive effects of terrorism on economy like this. Somebody benefited or makes profit from terrorism. And some countries maybe, or some companies maybe. What do you think about this relation with terrorism, or this relation between terrorism and this company or these countries?
Thank you very much.
Well, what I've tried to emphasize is the net effect for the country that's the target, which I think is most relevant. If the terrorist groups are trying to influence that country, I think you want to say how much pain are they causing in that country at an economic level, at a psychological level. You are probably right that enough substitution takes place that activity that would be done in the country that was targeted shifts to other countries. So worldwide GDP is probably affected even less. That's probably a fair point. Another point I would make, which was experienced in New York, and I think it's been experienced elsewhere, is these horrible disasters often accelerate changes that were taking place anyway. So if you look at the evolution of New York City, the downtown area, which was where the World Trade Towers were, and some of the surrounding buildings, which were destroyed, was in the process of becoming more residential. And actually, I think it makes sense for that section of New York. I think it makes sense for a lot more of New York to become more residential. And that had been going on, and business had been migrating more uptown, and that was accelerated. So that's kind of another, I'm kind of reluctant to emphasize anything positive, and I don't think this is necessarily positive, but it is as kind of a positive observation, positive in the Lionel Robbins sense, as not normative, describing what was going on. It's something that sped up a change that had been in process.
On this benefiting from terrorism, I might just permit it one observation, that one of the great modern-day urban myths is this notion that, you know, the terrorists short stock ahead of the crises. This was a bane of my life when I was a financial regulator, because you kind of knew that this hadn't happened, except we did discover around 9/11 that there had been a significant shorting of British Airways stock, which had been done by the Lufthansa pension scheme, who had too much Lufthansa stock and wanted to find some way of hedging it,
right,
and had happened to have done this transaction a week or so ahead. And that was created a media storm. I mean, this was, you know, around the market, and we were supposed to be, you know, totally ignorant of Al-Qaeda activity. It was a nightmare. Anyway, there was somebody down here. Yeah, second row.
Hi there. This may be slightly uncomfortable question again, as you're a microeconomist, but an issue that you sort of talked upon, and I've looked at a little bit in my studies, the oil industry. I think this is something that you touched on with BP and Shell, but I think that there's potentially a lot more to be looked into, because of, obviously, if you have a as we have perhaps to some extent nowadays, a climate of terrorism, the price within the market is bid up, and obviously there's been a lot of research done through the 70s and the shocks on the global macroeconomy. I'd like to know your thoughts on that, and obviously with the vulnerability of the infrastructure going forwards, the issues in Nigeria, you know, what are the scopes for generally having an impact there?
Right, that's a very good question. I've been burned on this question before. I wrote a piece in the New York Times summarizing some of the academic literature, Hamilton's work, which suggests a pretty tight relationship historically between oil prices and the state of the economy. This is one of those cases where I would say measurement was ahead of theory. We had a strong relationship, but never a really compelling theory, I think, to explain why oil price shocks had such a big impact. Anyhow, I wrote a piece in the New York Times, one was about a year and a half ago, when oil prices started going through the roof, saying that this doesn't bode too well for the economy over the next few quarters and so on, and I talked to James Hamilton about it, and it turned out I was dead wrong. The economy seems to have kind of shrugged off the increase in oil prices. And the second thing that I did is another piece on kind of why. And one of the things which is quite striking is how inelastic the demand has been in the short run. And even over the last five-year period, people haven't been responding. They're not driving less. They still are buying big SUVs in the U.S. So I'm actually relatively pessimistic about the prospects for a gas tax reducing gas consumption by all that much in the U.S. With the goal of reducing greenhouse warming, at least in the relatively relatively long term even. So anyway, I guess I would tend to think of the oil industry as a very important industry. I think it's less central for the operation of the economy. I think it's less central now than I used to think. And that's one of the things, this is one of the reasons why I'm glad I'm not a macroeconomist. Because as soon as you think you have a very reliable relationship, it seems to break down.
Third row from the back, the tasteful beige sweater.
Professor
Thank you.
Bloom.
I wanted to ask, if you looked 1 to 2 years out on happiness, what happens after a truly catastrophic event, so 9/11, Katrina, or the election of George Bush?
I have no idea. For the terrorist attacks, when you look at you're asking when you look at kind of aggregate events, the only study I'm aware of is the one by Bruno Frey that I showed you, and that did not do very much with the time structure. So I don't know how robust its results are for that reason. There's a trend in microeconomics, which is not such a positive one, which is to do the kinds of things that one would do with time series data, with micro data, and then ignore the fact that you actually are using the time series data. So, for example, they have tens and tens of thousands of observations, but the shocks that they're looking at are coming, quarterly or annually. So there's a lot of dependence in the data which is not being adjusted for. And that's not only in their study. That's a pretty widespread problem, I would say, in the area in which I do most of my work. I will tell you this from the psychology literature that I've learned. People tend to grossly overestimate the effect of the election of various candidates. And there's something called the focusing illusion, where if you ask people about how bad something's going to be, they greatly, it'll be an enormous problem. And then, it wasn't that bad. We adapted. We figured out how to, not watch the news or not watch the State of the Union address so we can get by things. This presidency might be an exception to that rule, in some states at least. But that's a kind of an interesting, pretty well-established fact. So my guess is, and I expected to see more adaptation. Even though you see a lot of adaptation in these studies, my guess is that 2 years later you see even less. And if Frey were to extend his analysis with an additional year lag, that you would see things evaporating, is my guess.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about Iraq, which is now where the vast majority of terrorist attacks in the world today occur in Iraq, where there's several bombings every week. And clearly it has a massive effect. Economically, probably tens of percents of GDP, and on any other aspects, it prevents the government from functioning anything. Now, I guess by your definition, you would say that this is civil war because there are more than 1,000 deaths a year, but it seems that the tactic also makes a very important difference here. I would think if you imagined you would have had the same number of casualties in, let's say, some actual battles occurring somewhere in Iraq between two sides, killing, let's say, the population of two towns or something like that, that would amount to the same number of casualties, but would not be as random. And my feeling is that the effect would have been completely different. And I wonder whether you agree that the randomness of terror and this feeling that you have no idea whether you'll go out into the street in Baghdad or in Basra or any town in Iraq, whether you will be able to come back home alive, that has a very big effect on top of the actual number of casualties, which is very high there.
Parts of your question I have difficulty answering, but let me say the following. I would put Iraq in the category of blunders, of government missteps in response to terrorism. And I think that I would go back and say I would attribute the losses in Iraq to a large extent to an irrational response to 9/11. Now, I think historians are going to debate whether the Bush administration, some elements of the Bush administration wanted to invade Iraq before 9/11, and 9/11 was a pretense. But even if that was the case, it was a pretense that made it easier. A large share of the American public believed Iraq was somehow connected with 9/11. So this is why I'm in both camps on the big effect and the small effect. I agree with you that for the United States, involvement in Iraq is extremely costly. It's going to continue to be very costly for a long time, I believe. And I attribute a reasonable share of that to the response to terrorism. So that's one way of sidestepping your argument and agreeing with you. What do you call what's going on in Iraq? The difficulty is we know very little about the insurgency. I mean, it's really kind of Robert McNamara wrote a book called The Fog of War, and there's a wonderful movie about it, where he emphasized the importance of knowing your enemy, which he learned the hard way. And the misperceptions in the American government about North Vietnam and what they were fighting for was quite remarkable. And it seems to me we're repeating the same mistakes, that we have relatively little understanding, very little public understanding, of who the insurgency is composed of. I believe that there are different strands to it. Some of them I think you would call fighting a civil war, and I'm happy to call the situation overall as a civil war. Some groups are more terrorist organizations, which are not part of the larger effort. Even in the larger effort, they're using terrorist tactics. So I think you have all of that going on in Iraq. About the fear, I honestly don't know if it's very different. I mean, I just don't know. I couldn't say. I mean, I imagine if you think about a conventional war, you know, a bombing campaign anywhere in the world, it reaps a considerable amount of fear, too. And maybe it's not terribly different than what's being perceived in Iraq today. I just don't know.
I've noticed that, like all Americans I've met, you are unaware of the decisive influence of our own prime minister on the U.S. administration, preventing them from making these policy errors. That this is something you really need to learn
about.
I've
tried to avoid my 3 days here saying anything controversial.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Glenn Siegel. You started off your talk 3 nights ago by saying that terror is a tactic. Say, in other words, a means to an end. And you've concluded tonight by telling us that the ends have not been rather successful in terms of terror. Could you give us a cost-benefit ratio analysis in econometric terms of the means to the ends, from the start to the end, the tactics and the solutions of terrorism consequences?
How long have we got?
I can't give you a fully specified econometric estimate, but I can say I've come to believe that terrorism is rational on the part of the terrorist organizations, that the benefit-cost calculations they're doing are probably correct. Not always. Sometimes it's kind of random and counterproductive. But for the aims that they have in mind, I suspect that they're using the most efficient methods that they have. Now, why do I say that? Well, they seem to be pretty rational in the way they are targeting industries. It seems to me almost that the timing is pretty rational, too. Rational in the sense of kind of getting the biggest bang for their buck. Now, if you go back, Bill Clinton complained after Al-Qaeda attacked one of our ships with a suicide boat and destroyed the ship, extremely expensive. You know, we're going to send $500,000, $1 million cruise missiles to knock out some tents in Afghanistan. It seems to me that for the investment that they're making, from their perspective, they're probably getting a very high return. On the other hand, they're also starting from an extremely disadvantaged position in terms of getting what they want. So I think one has to take that into account as well. But I guess the short answer I would give you is the benefit-cost ratio from their perspective, I suspect, is positive.
I'm going to take one last question right from the back because we're coming right to the end of this marathon and people are going to start overtaking you if...
Thank you.
Hello. I'm just curious about what your opinion is on the effect of terrorism on, say, foreign investment. Especially in less developed countries, and also if that could possibly be a barrier to growth?
That's a very good question. I'm trying to say this diplomatically. The only study is that I'm aware of on foreign direct investment is the one by Alberto Abadie and his co-author Javier Garbizal. And it's an inherently difficult issue to study, because there are many, many factors that affect foreign direct investment flows. They did find substantial effects. It's the type of study that ordinarily, I think, just by the nature of the issue that's being studied, that one would be cautious about interpreting. One of the things I learned in my research, there was an earlier Robbins lecture by Robert Barrow on the effects of education on economic growth. And when one estimates cross-country models, the results are often very fragile. And I think it's just the nature of the issue. And I showed you results here yesterday, which were the same kinds of regressions with data that are probably less dependable than the data that are often used in that kind of analysis. But what makes me a little bit more confident in what I showed you yesterday than I would be ordinarily is that it seemed to combine, it seemed to mesh pretty well with the evidence at the individual level. So that kind of all stayed together. I would say it's a fairly open question, but the one study that's out there does find the large effect.
Thank you very much for the questions and answers and for your three lectures. I know they've been hugely popular here, and you can see by the range of questions and the issues you've raised that you've stimulated a lot of thinking, which is what the Robbins lectures are intended to do. I particularly appreciated the elegance of coming back to a Robbins quote near the end, and it's nice that every 40 years his book will be taken out of Princeton Library. So we've much appreciated it, and we're very grateful, and we'll now give you a drink and something to eat.
Very
Thank
good.
You.
Thank you. Thank you.